Wonderful. And here we are, Thursday, August the 24th, 2017. Who'd have thought it, Shane McKenzie? 2017, and we're still standing.
Woohoo!
Yeah, exactly. Good stuff there. Okay, so the weather today, highs of 20 degrees centigrade, lows of 12 degrees centigrade. It's going to be a day with variable cloud cover, with possibility of a few showers, and light to moderate winds.
The truth is always out there. Sometimes way out there. With the Midweek Drive team on Siren 107.3 FM.
Results are very much in the offing when it comes to academic work and so on. And yet it would seem that in a recent survey, as we approach GCSE results day, of course, three quarters of British parents didn't receive the guidance that they needed to pursue their dream job as a youngster. And half of British parents are worried that their level of understanding of today's ever-changing career landscape could indeed hinder their child's future. We talk about areas relating to career portfolios and such like stuff. Anyway, to address this and hopefully begin to shed some light on the whole issue, we're delighted to welcome a dynamic duo, managing partner for talent, first of all at EY, that would be Maggie Stillwell. Good morning, Maggie.
Good morning.
And indeed somebody who's part of the EY group, that's Jade Garner. Good morning, Jade.
Morning.
Maggie, tell us a little bit about EY, what it is and how in essence this is a way of actually hopefully addressing the 21st century challenge when it comes to children and careers.
Yeah, well, EY is a big employer of graduates and in the last 5 years, a big employer of school leavers. And I guess increasingly what we've become aware of is that there seems to be a gap in the advice that students are getting, whether that's from parents, from their schools, whether it's from employers. And today, the launch of our parental campaign, we hope, is a big step forward in addressing that gap. because parents are the number one source of advice when it comes to children making those really important decisions about, do I go to university? Do I start my career? What else could I do if I don't want to go to university at this point? So parental advice is all about supporting better conversations with our children.
Have we actually progressed from the days where you'd actually go to see the careers advisor at school and it might be in a dingy office and they might well turn around at you and say, oh, you can't possibly be an actor, you can't possibly be a radio producer, you can't possibly do this. You've got a bank or post office.
So I think from what I understand from chatting to students, there is a huge variability in the quality of careers advice in those little offices, as you describe them. I think that the bigger issue possibly is that maybe students are relying more on parents and friends of parents for advice, and yet parents really don't feel equipped to give good advice. And it's perhaps unsurprising when we think about the speed and the scale of change in jobs that are available, and a big gap that we're seeing in the kinds of roles that children are thinking they're going to go into versus the roles that we've been successful in as parents.
Jade, if we can turn to yourself for a moment. I mean, you have joined EY, you've been with the company now for a year, you found out about the places that they actually offer through a local careers fair, you're now working within the audit insurance department. Is this something which, in a sense, just spoke to the inner you as being the best way forward, as opposed to, well, maybe I should just go to university for 3 years and see what happens then?
I mean, yeah, there's so much competition for graduate places for when you leave university, and tuition fees are an all-time high. So it sort of made me question whether I wanted to definitely go to university or not. And then I found out about this opportunity and I thought I might as well apply for it and give it a go. And, you know, if I get in, then great. And if I don't, I've got university to fall back on. But I thought, getting my foot in the door in such a big company and getting experience whilst gaining qualifications, it just made sense to me.
And from your own perspective, what advice would you actually give to parents in terms of, you know, obviously the challenge? Because, you know, children in most cases want to actually please their parents, but you've got that challenge of, well, are my parents then living vicariously through myself? You know, what's the way forward? What advice would you actually suggest is the best way to follow?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is really difficult to please your parents because the world is so different to when they were leaving school and either going to university or applying for jobs. So I think it's really important to have that conversation and make them realise that the world is a very different place now, the type of jobs are changing, the types of apprenticeships on offer are changing. So I think it's really important to have that conversation and, you know, to just tell them what's on offer and show them. And then they may understand that, you know, university isn't the only option and there are some really big companies offering amazing experiences straight out of school.
Maggie, back to yourself. I mean, looking at the list of careers here, the one that really struck me as being quite extraordinary and something which we would not have even considered back in the 20th century is a YouTuber, which is very popular in Scotland, it would seem, as well as fashion designers and vets, etc. But we see the photographers, doctors, etc. Faced with something like that, and you know, parents who might sort of think, what is this YouTube? Is it something to do with plumbing or something? what sort of advice would you actually say? I mean, other than simply say, well, it's a changing world, you have to deal with it.
So the research did show that actually parents, more than a third of parents that we surveyed would actually be unhappy for their child to follow that kind of career, and almost half really not confident about advising their children how to start. And I'd include myself in that. I think that's one of the reasons why we've created this hub with advice for parents to help them start that conversation with their children and think about the options that would literally never available to them when they were of that age. The world has changed and it is uncomfortable, and that's not a good place to be, to have parents worrying that actually they might not be able to support their children in such an important decision that they're making.
We spoke earlier about the notion of the career portfolio. It's something which certainly we speak to our students at the University of Lincoln about quite extensively. Is that something where, unless you're looking for a vocational career like a doctor, possibly like a lawyer, you are looking maybe to actually have transferable skills which you can use in your career lifetime across a variety of options?
Yeah, it's a great observation, and that is the way that career futurists say we will go, and therefore how important it is for young people to think about where are their strengths, what do they love doing, what will be things which they are going to be great at doing that are going to give some longevity to a career. Because as you say, it's simply not the case anymore that you would necessarily start your life as a lawyer and end your career as a lawyer. That breadth of skills is so important to anything you want to do on a portfolio basis.
And were there any careers from your own point of view, Maggie, which you thought, I wish if I had another opportunity, I wouldn't be managing partner for towns at EY. I'd go and become a computer programmer somewhere. Was there anything that sort of caught your own eye from your own perspective?
Well, I think I was amused when I looked at the research because, yes, I would count myself as someone who has ended up in a career that I didn't think I would be. And certainly my parents, they always gave me support to do what I wanted, but they didn't understand the world that I'm now in. And so that they weren't able to give me that guidance. They were always there to have a great conversation with and to give me support. But I'd count myself as someone who'd have answered the same as those parents in the survey.
And the key thing, of course, being choice can create challenges, but ultimately it's a case of the more information you've actually got, the more informed your opinions can actually be.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, we want young people to really have those ambitions, fuel those ambitions and go towards things that they're going to love, you know. I think it is quite sad, really, that two-thirds of parents are in a career they didn't think they would be. You know, a fifth never even dreamt of doing their current role. So how can we bring to life what our young people really want to do in the world and help their parents feel part of that decision-making process?
Best place to go to online or elsewhere to find out further information, Maggie, where would you suggest?
Yes, so go and have a look at our hub, ukcareers.ey.uk. Join the conversation, hashtag parental advice. We just want to get the nation talking about this incredibly important topic.
Absolutely. I think we'd also like to add that it's not just for literally the week of the GCSE results or indeed prior to that. You know, it's something you can actually probably engage with really long beforehand and throughout the year, really. It's always useful to work through on that basis. Maggie, it's been sensational touching base with your good self. And Jade, many thanks indeed. And we wish you both the very, very best. Take care now.
Thank you.
Maggie Stillwell there from EY Careers. Of course, back in the day when he's in South Africa and not dealing with a variety of other aspects as a young man, I'm sure Richard Fitzwilliam said, what I most want to be is a royal correspondent and a film critic and possibly editor of International Who's Who. Or did you just sort of say, Richard, I'll go where the fancy takes me as far as my career is concerned?
More the former than the latter, but you never know, of course, what the future brings.
Exactly, and the future is a very scary place. In the studio we have Shaylee McKenzie, who's been perusing the catalogue of the event we were focusing on yesterday, which was the Into the Unknown exhibition at the Barbican. Sadly, we didn't manage to meet up for reasons which, in the future, when we write our memoirs, will all be made quite clear and explicit. But meanwhile, it's pleasing to know that when I said Catherine Bigelow directed one of your movies today, I think it's fair to say, Shaylee, you're quite excited.
It sounds really interesting.
Mm-hmm. And it's got The Falcon, and it's also got the chap from Star Wars in it, Anthony Mackie and John Boyega, etc.
Anthony Mackie, yes, from the Hurt Locker. I'm an amazing director. I was delighted to attend the press conference for this film and actually tell Catherine Bigelow how much I admired her work. And also, I was talking about the immersive experience that you get plunged into in films like The Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty, and also Detroit. She's got this ability to turn a movie into it's not just a docudrama, it's the way it's filmed that insofar as obviously you are in the cinema, but I mean, it is somewhat immersive. In Detroit, you sweat it out.
In terms of the historical factor, it's probably fair to say that already critics have been jumping on the bandwagon saying this is the best one ever, etc., which is what they said about Dunkirk, and you know my feeling about that. Although it has to be said, Shaley did enjoy Dunkirk. Looking at the overall system, is this one that you're likely to see in the Academy Awards, Richard?
I think it may very well feature. Bigelow's got this. It is an amazing ability to choose topics, and then when she gets her story going, she draws you into it. And just to build the plot up for a second, it's set in 1967 Detroit. The returns of some veterans, and they're having a party at a non-licensed nightclub, and the racial tensions are pretty high. There's an almost entirely all-white police force, and the areas that are mainly black are, putting it mildly, estranged from it when the police actually raid it, and the way they treat people, a crowd gathers, and what starts, I mean, it's a period of the Vietnam War, and I mean, this becomes a war zone. So the way she films this is absolutely brilliant. If you know what's going on in Vietnam, and then you see shots of Detroit burning, I mean, it is extraordinary. And the way this is filmed, I mean, I really, 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 you think of sequences in, as I say, The Hurt Locker, or in perhaps the, coming to Doug Liman in a moment, so it's just this Syntagma Square sequence in one of the Bourne films. I mean, it has got this validity, and as a result, you're drawn in. And we have John Boyega, who plays Melvin Desmukes, who is a security guard at in a shop near where some of the rioting is occurring, and he becomes friendly with some of the police. And this draws him in to a terrifying, the Algiers Motel incident it got became known as. What happens is that we follow the fortunes, if that's the word, of the Dramatics, a professional black R&B group. They're in Detroit. The music hall shut down during the riot. So the lead singer, Larry Reed, played by Algie Smith, and his friend, they rent a room at the Algiers Motel. There are two white girls there, Julianne, played by Hannah Murray, and Karen, played by Captain Denver, and also they're befriending a vet, Green, played by Anthony Mackie. What happens is that one of the characters who's messing around there fires blanks from a starter gun at troops who the National Guard and the Army have been brought into Detroit, and believing it's a sniper, they return fire. And then we see an incident that became notorious in American history. Enter Philip Krause, played by Will Poulter, we watched him grow up on screen, and my goodness, he's good here. He's a vicious, racist cop, and we met him earlier in the film when he's shot with a shotgun, a looter in the back. This is totally contrary to police regulations, and so what you've obviously got here is somebody who's to find this gun, he's prepared to draw others into macabre games whereby you submit individuals, all of the people who are in the motel are put up against the wall, and one by one they're interrogated, and the most ghastly things happen. I mean, this is no spoilers, but this and what happens subsequently really will shock you as they are up against the wall. So insofar as so you're in a comfortable cinema seat, but you are there with them insofar as you can be. You do sweat it out a bit, because this movie is very, very well made. It's extremely well acted. Will Poulter's racist cop is a superb creation, and there's no question that the whole cast is excellent. Boyega, good too, in a role where he basically, to keep alive, as he's a security guard, his uniform gives him protection to a point. So what happens in this movie will really, really fascinate, especially since she's got Mark Boll to do the script again, as and also it's visually so impressive. Briglow's really scored with this movie, and it is part of American history which was shameful. I'm very sorry to say that I didn't know of the incident, and the only fault I can make with reference to how the movie has been put together is that if you don't know that it's a true story, I would think it's much better to say so in the just after the opening credits, if there are any, simply because not everyone does know. And if you do, and I didn't, that adds an extra, as it were, layer to the drama, because it could, if you didn't know, have been a story that had been, or fictional story, in the middle of this chaos.
Shaley, is that a kind of movie you're going to be going to check out?
Absolutely, that sounds really good. And the thing that I'm really interested in, having just watched the trailer with Alex, is how gritty the whole human experience of that racial tension really looks. And the way she shot it is just like, it's not glossy at all, it's not meant to be glossy, and that's something that really interests me, because it's almost, although it's not relatable to me, it can be relatable, and it looks relatable because it's not shiny and glossy, it's nitty gritty, and like you say, you sweat it out.
And don't, of course, as well as, in fact, I saw this at the time of Charlotteville, and I mean, the relevance today is obvious.
Incredible, yeah, definitely.
Which really, really packs a punch.
That was the 1960s. In the 80s, 20 years later, Tom Cruise apparently stars as Barry Seal, a pilot-turned-drug smuggler who's recruited by the CIA for a dangerous mission. What other kind of recruiting mission is there, really? The CIA are going to recruit you for a nice, calm, easy mission, aren't they? You know, take this along. Made by the director, of course, of Edge of Tomorrow, Doug Liman, is your next selection, Richard.
Oh, my goodness me, it is, yes. And I mean, this is terrific. One point I would like to make about this movie, it's not only well filmed and acted, Tom Cruise in excellent form as this extraordinary figure, the Barry Seal, is almost legendary. And it's a movie that links to their rather obvious films that it's similar to, like Charlie Wilson's War or The Wolf of Wall Street, where you've got, and War Dogs, you've got the most outrageous things going on, and a lot of it actually did happen. And this begins by saying it's based on a true story, and my goodness me, it's well done. But also I could hear everything. This is a problem, a major problem with so many movies, that when characters are, when they're sometimes inarticulate, or indeed there's some sort of dialect involved, it can be very, very difficult. I found this on stage a bit recently. Even in The Ferryman, I have to say, there are quite long passages, and also in Cat in the Hot Tin Roof, which I found hard to hear. This really, really, well, you can hear every word in this, because Tom Cruise intends that you should. Why not? Because we must follow the plot. Barry Seal, a former TWA pilot, becomes a drug smuggler recruited by the CIA to help counter the communist threat in a period of Latin America. It begins with some documentary footage. We begin with a speech by President Carter, and subsequently most of it is set in the era of President Reagan and the links with the Contras in Nicaragua, and also remember the Iran-Contra scandal, Colonel Oliver North, it leads up to that. But you've got someone here who's, and who's a consistently entertaining story, because it's so absolutely outrageous. The sheer audacity of Seal is hard to convey simply verbally, because he tells you the story himself. On a video, he addresses, through this video, the audience and mentions what he got up to. And, I mean, there's some extraordinary things here involving trips to the Latin American countries for the CIA, and then getting involved in the Medellin drug cartel at the same time, and then doing the Panama run for a certain General Noriega, with whom he gets on extremely well. All those kickbacks. The way he avoids capture is quite extraordinary. There's one scene here, talk about crash landing to escape. I'll say no more, but that is just something that will stay with you. And what is amazing is that he's supposed to be taking rifles to the Contras, or guns to the Contras, and he is also working for the Medellin drug cartel. He takes cocaine to the Contras, and the cartel get the guns. Little problems occur when aware that he's been involved in nefarious activity, but knowing that he's the guy who always delivers, that's the punchline here. The CIA actually buy a home for him and his long-suffering wife. She does enjoy it when things are going well. We have Karen Wright, Sarah Wright playing Lucy, and Lucy is not not very enviable when things are going wrong. This has 200 acres, and they actually try and train some Contras on it. The Contras are far more interested in being smuggled into America and then disappearing or drinking. The irony in this, if this is the way a foreign policy of the world's most powerful nation is run, well, I think you could look at it now and you could say there couldn't be anything more absurd. Charlie Wilson's war, where the vast amounts of material, that was the biggest in history, was shipped to the Taliban. Where have we heard of them recently to remove the Russians from Afghanistan? That succeeded. This is just absolutely extraordinary. I don't want to give out too many spoilers, but in fact, there are so many improbable things that go on. One thing it will do, it's colorful, it's well-filmed, the sound's absolutely superb. Tom Cruise is laconic, and is he a hero, anti-hero? Well, believe me, I mean, there's only one person you could possibly sympathize with, and it's certainly not Donald Gleason, CIA agent. It is Barry. It's just extraordinary, and it's a thoroughly likable film too, because it moves at a fast pace. In fact, it's dazzlingly fast.
Really not sure in terms of the trailer where they use based on an unbelievable true story. Surely that's an oxymoron or bordering on that particular aspect. But I'm like,
not for you saying. I mean, it is really amazing. Even if only some of this went on, I mean, it's extraordinary.
Well, Shaley.
Yeah, no, I went off Tom Cruise a couple of years ago, but in this he looks like
the. So did Nicole Kidman when it happened.
Yeah, and Katie Holmes.
Exactly.
He seems like a cheeky chappy who just wanted to make a bit of money and has got caught up in. Was that Pablo Escobar we saw as well?
Oh, we do indeed, yeah.
Yeah, yes, see, I've always been interested in that since Narcos. That whole sort of story going on with Pablo and his family and
don't
the war
get
on drugs.
That's my advice.
Sage words, Richard. Sage words indeed. And finally, Jez Butterworth's The Ferryman on the London theatrical stage.
Yes, now this is epic. I mean, it's not only epic in length, it got a standing ovation. I mean, the expectations were very high after Jez Butterworth's triumph in Jerusalem with Mark Rylance, which was absolutely superb. Rylance playing the rooster, and it really was an amazing portrait, both of individuals and also of the state of England. This is set in Northern Ireland at the time of Bobby Sands' hunger strikes, and it's what is extraordinary about this? It's about the disappeared and what happens when one of the disappeared is found, and what happens to a family. Whilst the person's gone, you cling on to hopes. When the person's discovered dead, how does it affect matters in a family where there is both the wife of the disappeared, who's still clinging on to hopes and memories, and also a situation that's liable to get pretty explosive when members of the IRA want to hush matters up because they certainly don't want bad publicity at the time when the entire attention is on the hunger strikers. What happens can be quite shocking. But what's fascinating, and it's just a question, not only a superb cast here, but also what is really riveting is the way we see, set in Armagh, the way Butterworth is able to link myths and legends and some most absolutely extraordinary dialogue. You get a feel for the past of Ireland and also for its very tortured and tormented presence. I noticed that playing Aunt Maggie Faraway, who's an elderly lady who sometimes comes up with poetic outbursts, is Brid Brennan, who I saw years ago playing Lady Macbeth, actually walking on the ramparts of Dunsinane at Stratford, which was quite interesting. It stars Paddy Considine, and I mean, the whole cast is absolutely excellent, but it's a play that, again, is somewhat immersive because you see the time of the harvest festival, and that gives characters an opportunity to talk about Ireland's past and talk so lyrically. This is where Butterworth is so very, very good with the dialogue. But there's also the terrifying presence when you have one of the disappeared discovered. It can be an experience that, putting it mildly here, it's unforgettable because, of course, the effect it has is, well, no spoilers again, but the IRA are very keen to play things down, and you're pretty heavy-handed. And what can a family do? This is a play to be savoured, and it's wonderful to see. It's a 3.5-hour epic evening, and it's epic in its scope, but it's in this extraordinary, it's not just a situation where we actually hear Margaret Thatcher, we have the political resonances. What you've got is this extraordinary ability for magical dialogue, which, as it were, gives you a flair, a feeling for the past of a nation, and that's where it really scores.
It's currently at the Royal Court in London until the 20th of May, and then transfers over to the Gielgud London from the 20th of June to the 7th of October.
Oh, no, that's where it is, at the Gielgud.
It's at the Gielgud. You're quite right. Exactly. It's at the Gielgud. Thank you for that.
And it's packing them out, believe me, as I say. It's nice. It's so good to see a really spontaneous standing ovation. You don't see many, and sometimes when I see a really first-class play and you wish someone would, you know, everyone would stand up, and then you have half a dozen people standing up, and it just doesn't necessarily take ours off. I mean, this had tremendous expectations because of the rave reviews Jerusalem got. It perhaps isn't quite as successful as that, but then practically nothing has been. So Butterworth, one of our top playwrights, no question about it.
And it was directed by Sam Mendes as well.
Oh,
so
indeed, yes.
He's done two Bonds and American Beauty, so what's not to appreciate?
The Road to Perdition too, as I remember. Based on
a fine graphic novel indeed by Richard Piers Raymond, a personal friend and colleague. So there we are. Moving on, from your own point of view, Shaley, would you be checking out the theatrical work of Sam Mendes, and in particular Butterworth's The Ferryman?
No, I'd love to. Yeah, it sounds really good. I've been in love with Paddy Considine since I saw him in Dead Man's Shoes. I think he's an incredible actor. And is this his debut, isn't it, in the stage?
I am not well versed.
We'll obviously have to investigate further, but still, you're a Paddy Considine fan, and that makes it all worthwhile.
You are right. I have the programme here, and he's done, as you mentioned, quite a lot of film, and as writer, as a director, and also television. This is indeed his debut as Quinn Kearney, a character to be reckoned with, I would have to say. Very interesting. It's a superbly structured play. You meet the family and you get to know the individual members. It's harvest time, and it links with myths and traditions. But you also had the first scene where the IRA seized on the local priest and basically told him to make sure that as this corpse has turned up, so they don't want to hear any more about it. And if he fails, they'll pitch up at the farmhouse, and they'll make very sure that, or will they, that things are kept quiet. The hunger strikers are getting enormous publicity. And also, of course, there is the matter of commitment to the cause of the IRA and the way commitment may waver if circumstances change.
Coming up on the programme, we'll be speaking to Ian Lennox with his Tyneside thoughts. We've got Dr. Justin Varney talking about the importance of exercise for middle-aged folk. Amazing. We'll also be speaking to Eva MacDonald, and probably Professor Fiona Moore will give us her thoughts on the Barbicans Into the Unknown exhibition. But as we've had three thumbs up for the American-made Detroit and the Ferryman, last two questions for Richard, please. Shaley.
Have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today, Richard?
Oh, enormously, because talking about works like this, I mean, it is a real pleasure, and I hope everyone's going to check them out because they're so good in different ways.
It's worth it, definitely. Can we rely on you next week?
Oh, I hope so.
Mm. Nice.
You play with her, and then you throw it away.